When you have chosen not to store up your rewards on earth, have you stored them in heaven? Michael Gleghorn examines the law of rewards now on Probe.
The hit movie Gladiator begins with a powerful scene. Just before engaging the German barbarians in battle, General Maximus addresses some of his Roman soldiers. "Brothers," he says, "what we do in life echoes in eternity." Although Maximus was a pagan, his statement is entirely consistent with biblical Christianity, particularly the Bible's teaching on eternal rewards. In The Law of Rewards, Randy Alcorn writes, "While our faith determines our eternal destination, our behavior determines our eternal rewards. The Bible clearly teaches that we are saved by God's grace through personal faith in Christ, apart from any works whatever. But it also teaches, with equal clarity, that we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that we may be recompensed for what we have done in the body, whether good or bad. This judgment, which is only for believers, is not to determine whether or not we are saved. Its purpose is to evaluate our works and determine whether we shall receive or lose eternal rewards." Alcorn writes, "Our works are what we have done with our resources. At the judgment seat of Christ, the quality of our work will be tested with fire. If we have used quality building materials, then our work will endure and we will be rewarded by the Lord. If we have used poor building materials, then our work will be consumed, and we will suffer the loss of rewards." This raises some important questions. What are we doing with the resources that God has entrusted to us? Are we seeking to build God's kingdom in God's way, empowered by His Spirit? Or are we merely engaged in empire building for our own glory? Are we investing our resources in reaching the world for Christ, making disciples, and helping the poor and needy? Or are we only concerned with satisfying our own immediate wants and desires? It's here that the worldview dimensions of our subject can be most clearly seen. Most of us would probably find it difficult to use our resources in the service of God or our fellow man if we thought that this life was all there is and that death is the end of our personal existence. But Christianity says that there's more, a lot more. And if Christianity is true, then Maximus was right. What we do in life echoes in eternity. Randy Alcorn has observed, "The missing ingredient in the lives of countless Christians today is motivation. The doctrine of eternal rewards for our obedience is the neglected key to unlocking our motivation."
You've been listening to Probe with your host, Michael Gleghorn. If you'd like a free copy of Michael's transcript, The Law of Rewards, based on Randy Alcorn's book, visit us online at probe.org. Again, that's probe.org. Join us next time as we help you look at life with a biblical worldview, God's view, here on Probe.
Is the desire for eternal rewards a proper or legitimate motivation for serving Christ? Isn't it somewhat shallow, maybe even selfish, for our service to Christ to be motivated by a desire for heavenly rewards? Furthermore, shouldn't we serve Christ simply because of who He is, rather than for what we can get out of it? To some people, the promise of eternal rewards sounds like a crass appeal to our baser instincts. But is it? Before we jump to any unwarranted conclusions and possibly overstate the case, we may first want to take a step back, take a deep breath, and remind ourselves of a few things. In the first place, as Randy Alcorn observes, it wasn't our idea that God would reward us. It was His idea. If we search the pages of the New Testament, we repeatedly find promises of heavenly rewards for earthly obedience. Indeed, Jesus Himself urges our obedience in light of future rewards. Not only that, in Matthew 6:20, He commands us to store up for ourselves treasures in heaven. Now this leads to an interesting little twist. In John 14:21, Jesus says, "Whoever has my commands and obeys them, he is the one who loves me." We could make the argument then that the one who does not seek to store up treasures in heaven is being disobedient to Christ's command and demonstrating a lack of love for Him. In a somewhat similar vein, Randy Alcorn has written, "It is certainly true that desire for reward should not be our only motivation. But it is also true that it's a fully legitimate motive encouraged by God. In fact, the two most basic things we can believe about God are first that He exists, and second that He is a rewarder of those who diligently seek Him. Of course, we must always remember that the Lord knows the motivations of our hearts, and these will be taken into account at the judgment seat of Christ. In addition, Jesus solemnly warns us, 'Be careful not to do your acts of righteousness before men, to be seen by them. If you do, you will have no reward from your Father in heaven.'" The biblical picture of rewards, then, would seem to go something like this. the Lord is absolutely worthy of our obedience and service, whether we ever personally profit from it or not. Nevertheless, the Lord is a rewarder of those who seek Him, and He commands us to seek His rewards as well. And when one really thinks about it, hearing our Master say, "Well done," will not simply be for our pleasure, but also for His. What kind of life does God reward? For what sort of works will believers be rewarded when they stand before the judgment seat of Christ? The simplest answer to this question, and the most general, is that we will be rewarded for everything we've done that was motivated by our love for the Lord and empowered by His Spirit. Indeed, Jesus said that we would even be rewarded for simply giving a cup of cold water to someone because he is a follower of Christ. But the Bible specifically mentions many other things for which we can also be rewarded. The New Testament describes as many as 5 different crowns, which will be given to believers for various works of faithfulness, obedience, discipline, and love. For example, there is the imperishable crown, which appears to be rewarded for determination, discipline, and victory in the Christian life. There is the crown of righteousness, which according to Paul will be awarded by the Lord to all who have longed for His appearing. There is the crown of life given for faithfulness to Christ in persecution or martyrdom. In the book of Revelation, Jesus tells the church in Smyrna, "The devil will put some of you in prison to test you, and you will suffer persecution for 10 days. Be faithful even to the point of death, and I will give you the crown of life." Additionally, there is the crown of rejoicing, given for pouring oneself into others in evangelism and discipleship. And finally, there is the crown of glory, given for faithfully representing Christ in a position of leadership. Of course, as Randy Alcorn observes, there's nothing in this list that suggests it's exhaustive. Indeed, as we've already seen, the Bible seems to say that we will be rewarded for every act of love and service which we did for the glory of God. But there's another side to this discussion which we dare not overlook. The Bible not only indicates that we can gain rewards, it also warns us that we can lose them as well. Paul compared the Christian life to an athletic competition in which our goal is to win the prize. "This is why," he told the Corinthians, "I beat my body and make it my slave, so that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified for the prize." The Bible suggests that the work of some believers will be completely consumed at the judgment seat of Christ. Tragically, these believers will enter heaven without any rewards from their Lord. To avoid this catastrophe, then, let us heed the advice of the Apostle Paul and run in such a way as to get the prize. What should we think about power, pleasures, and possessions? Are they merely temptations that should be avoided, or genuine goods that can be legitimately sought and desired? Although some may find it surprising, each of these things is good, at least considered simply in itself. Each finds its ultimate source in God, and each existed before sin and evil corrupted His good creation. God has always been powerful. He clearly took pleasure in His work of creation, repeatedly describing it as good. And as the creator of all that exists, everything ultimately belongs to God. Indeed, the Bible sometimes describes Him as the possessor of heaven and earth. Clearly, then, there's nothing inherently wrong with power, pleasures, or possessions. So why have these things gained such tainted reputations? Probably because they've so often been misused and abused by sinful men and women. Indeed, describing sin and evil as the misuse, abuse, perversion, or corruption of some good gift of God is part of a long and venerable tradition in the history of philosophy and theology. And one doesn't have to look very far to find plenty of examples of man's sinful misuse of power, pleasures, and possessions. But we must always remember that it's the misuse of these things that is sinful and wrong. The things in themselves are good and desirable. And this is confirmed by the teaching of Scripture. Consider the kind of rewards God offers us. For faithful and obedient service now, He promises power, pleasures, and possessions in eternity. Jesus made it clear that those who are faithful with the little things in this life will be rewarded with great power and authority in the next. He taught that those who invest their time, talents, and treasures in building God's kingdom here and now are laying up great treasures in heaven for themselves in the hereafter. And pleasures? The psalmist wrote of God, "In thy presence is fullness of joy, in thy right hand there are pleasures forever." Randy Alcorn has written, "God has created us each with desires for pleasure, possessions, and power. We want these things not because we are sinful, but because we are human. Although our sinfulness can, and often does, lead us to misuse these things, we've seen that they're actually good gifts of God. Power, possessions, and pleasures are legitimate objects of desire that our Creator has instilled in us, and by which He can motivate us to obedience. May we faithfully serve the Lord, trusting Him as the rewarder of those who diligently seek Him. A Christian worldview must be fleshed out in the rough-and-tumble world of our daily lives if we're going to be salt and light to the surrounding culture. Now, as always, true disciples must be doers of the Word, and not merely hearers who delude themselves. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus told His followers, "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." Many of us read these verses and only hear Jesus' command not to store up treasures on earth. But if this is all we hear, then we're missing the main point that Jesus is trying to make. As Randy Alcorn observes, the central focus of this passage is not the renunciation of earthly treasures, but the accumulation of heavenly treasures. We're to avoid storing up unnecessary treasures on earth, not as an end in itself, but as a life strategy to lay up treasures in heaven. In a sense, Jesus is calling us to adopt a long-term investment strategy. Think about the fate of all our earthly treasures. Isn't Jesus right? Won't they either wear out, break down, rust, become outdated, or get stolen? Either it leaves us while we live, or we leave it when we die. So is it really smart to pour all our time and energy into the accumulation of earthly treasures? Is this really a wise investment strategy? We've spent this week discussing issues raised by Randy Alcorn's excellent little book, The Law of Rewards. I can think of no better way to conclude than with a powerful and thought-provoking citation from this book. "Gather your family and go visit a junkyard or a dump. Look at all the piles of treasures that were formerly Christmas and birthday presents. Point out things that people worked long hours to buy and paid hundreds of dollars for, that children quarreled about, friendships were lost over, honesty was sacrificed for, and marriages broke up over. Look at the remnants of gadgets and furnishings that now lie useless after their brief lifespan. Remind yourself that most of what you own will one day end up in a junkyard like this. And even if it survives on earth for a while, you won't. When you examine the junkyard, ask yourself this question: when all that I ever owned lies abandoned, broken, useless, and forgotten, what will I have done with my life that will last for eternity?"